The Works of Edgar Allan Poe, Volume 5. Philosophy of Furniture. In the internal decoration, if not in the external architecture of their residences, the English are supreme. The Italians have but little sentiment beyond marbles and colors. In France, meliora probant, deteriora sequitur, the people are too much a race of gadabouts to maintain those household proprieties of which, indeed, they have a delicate appreciation, or at least the elements of a proper sense. The Chinese and most of the Eastern races have a warm but inappropriate fancy. The Scotch are poor decorists. The Dutch have, perhaps, an indeterminate idea that a curtain is not a cabbage. In Spain they are all curtains, a nation of hangmen. The Russians do not furnish. The Hottentots and Kickapoos are very well in their way. The Yankees alone are preposterous. How this happens, it is not difficult to see. We have no aristocracy of blood, and having therefore as a natural, and indeed as an inevitable thing, fashioned for ourselves an aristocracy of dollars, the display of wealth has here to take the place and perform the office of the heraldic display in monarchical countries. By a transition readily understood, and which might have been as readily foreseen, we have been brought to merge in simple show our notions of taste itself. To speak less abstractly. In England, for example, no mere parade of costly appurtenances would be so likely as with us, to create an impression of the beautiful in respect to the appurtenances themselves or of taste as regards the proprietor. This for the reason, first, that wealth is not, in England, the loftiest object of ambition as constituting a nobility, and secondly, that there, the true nobility of blood, confining itself within the strict limits of legitimate taste, rather avoids than affects that mere costliness in which a parvenu rivalry may at any time be successfully attempted. The people will imitate the nobles, and the result is a thorough diffusion of the proper feeling. But in America, the coins current being the sole arms of the aristocracy, their display may be said, in general, to be the sole means of the aristocratic distinction, and the populace, looking always upward for models, are insensibly led to confound the two entirely separate ideas of magnificence and beauty. In short, the cost of an article of furniture has at length come to be, with us, nearly the sole test of its merit in a decorative point of view, and this test, once established, has led the way to many analogous errors, readily traceable to the one primitive folly. There could be nothing more directly offensive to the eye of an artist than the interior of what is termed in the United States, that is to say, in a palaeca, a well-furnished apartment. Its most usual defect is a want of keeping. We speak of the keeping of a room as we would of the keeping of a picture, for both the picture and the room are amenable to those undeviating principles which regulate all varieties of art, and very nearly the same laws by which we decide on the higher merits of a painting, suffice for decision on the adjustment of a chamber. A want of keeping is observable sometimes in the character of the several pieces of furniture, but generally in their colors or modes of adaptation to use. Very often the eye is offended by their inartistic arrangement. Straight lines are too prevalent, too uninterruptedly continued or clumsily interrupted at right angles. If curved lines occur, they are repeated into unpleasant uniformity. By undue precision, the appearance of many a fine apartment is utterly spoiled. Curtains are rarely well disposed, or well chosen in respect to other decorations. With formal furniture, curtains are out of place, and an extensive volume of drapery of any kind is, under any circumstance, irreconcilable with good taste. The proper quantum, as well as the proper adjustment, depending upon the character of the general effect. Carpets are better understood of late than of ancient days, but we still very frequently err in their patterns and colors. The soul of the apartment is the carpet. From it are deduced not only the hues but the forms of all objects incumbent. A judge at common law may be an ordinary man. A good judge of a carpet must be a genius. Yet we have heard discoursing of carpets, with the air Don Mood and Kirev, fellows who should not and who could not be entrusted with the management of their own mustaches. Everyone knows that a large floor may have a covering of large figures, and that a small one must have a covering of small, yet this is not all the knowledge in the world. As regards texture, the Saxony is alone admissible. Brussels is the preter pluperfect tense of fashion, and Turkey is taste in its dying agonies. Touching pattern, a carpet should not be bedizened out like a Ricari Indian, all red chalk, yellow ochre, and cock's feathers. In brief, distinct grounds, and vivid circular or cycloid figures, of no meaning, are here median laws. The abomination of flowers, or representations of well-known objects of any kind, should not be endured within the limits of Christendom. Indeed, whether on carpets, or curtains, or tapestry, or ottoman coverings, all upholstery of this nature should be rigidly arabesque. As for those antique floor cloth and still occasionally seen in the dwellings of the rabble, cloths of huge, sprawling, and radiating devises, stripe interspersed, and glorious with all hues, among which no ground is intelligible. These are but the wicked invention of a race of time servers and money lovers, children of Baal and worshippers of Mammon Benthams, who, to spare thought and economize fancy, first cruelly invented the kaleidoscope, and then established joint stock companies to twirl it by steam. Glare is a leading error in the philosophy of American household decoration, an error easily recognized as deduced from the perversion of taste just specified. We are violently enamored of gas and of glass. The former is totally inadmissible within doors. Its harsh and unsteady light offends. No one having both brains and eyes will use it. A mild, or what artists term a cool light, with its consequent warm shadows, will do wonders for even an ill-furnished apartment. Never was a more lovely thought than that of the astral lamp. We mean, of course, the astral lamp proper, the lamp of Argand, with its original plain ground glass shade, and its tempered and uniform moonlight rays. The cut glass shade is a weak invention of the enemy. The eagerness with which we have adopted it, partly on account of its flashiness, but principally on account of its greater rest, is a good commentary on the proposition with which we began. It is not too much to say, that the deliberate employer of a cut glass shade, is either radically deficient in taste, or blindly subservient to the caprices of fashion. The life proceeding from one of these gaudy abominations is unequal, broken, and painful. It alone is sufficient to mar a world of good effect in the furniture subjected to its influence. Female loveliness, in especial, is more than one half disenchanted beneath its evil eye. In the matter of glass, generally, we proceed upon false principles. Its leading feature is glitter, and in that one word how much of all that is detestable do we express? Flickering, unquiet lights are sometimes pleasing to children and idiots, always so, but in the embellishment of a room they should be scrupulously avoided. In truth, even strong steady lights are inadmissible. The huge and unmeaning glass chandeliers, prism cut, gas lighted, and without shade, which dangle in our most fashionable drawing rooms, may be cited as the quintessence of all that is false in taste or preposterous in folly. The rage for glitter, because its idea has become, as we before observed, confounded with that of magnificence in the abstract, has led us, also, to the exaggerated employment of mirrors. We line our dwellings with great British plates, and then imagine we have done a fine thing. Now the slightest thought will be sufficient to convince anyone who has an eye at all, of the ill effect of numerous looking glasses, and especially of large ones. Regarded apart from its reflection, the mirror presents a continuous, flat, colorless, unrelieved surface, a thing always and obviously unpleasant. Considered as a reflector, it is potent in producing a monstrous and odious uniformity, and the evil is here aggravated, not in merely direct proportion with the augmentation of its sources, but in a ratio constantly increasing. In fact, a room with four or five mirrors arranged at random, is, for all purposes of artistic show, a room of no shape at all. If we add to this evil, the attendant glitter upon glitter, we have a perfect farrago of discordant and displeasing effects. The veriest bumpkin, on entering an apartment so bedizened, would be instantly aware of something wrong, although he might be altogether unable to assign a cause for his dissatisfaction. But let the same person be led into a room tastefully furnished, and he would be startled into an exclamation of pleasure and surprise. It is an evil growing out of our republican institutions, that here a man of large purse has usually a very little soul which he keeps in it. The corruption of taste is a portion or a pendant of the dollar manufacture. As we grow rich, our ideas grow rusty. It is, therefore, not among our aristocracy that we must look, if at all, in apolikia, for the spirituality of a British boudoir. But we have seen apartments in the tenure of Americans of moderns, possibly modest or moderate, means, which, in negative merit at least, might vie with any of the ormolude cabinets of our friends across the water. Even now, there is present to our mind's eye a small and not ostentatious chamber with whose decorations no fault can be found. The proprietor lies asleep on a sofa, the weather is cool, the time is near midnight. We will make a sketch of the room during his slumber. It is oblong, some 30 feet in length and 25 in breadth, a shape affording the best ordinary opportunities for the adjustment of furniture. It has but one door, by no means a wide one, which is at one end of the parallelogram, and but two windows, which are at the other. These latter are large, reaching down to the floor of deep recesses and open on an Italian veranda. Their panes are of a crimson tinted glass, set in rosewood framings, more massive than usual. They are curtained within the recess, by a thick silver tissue adapted to the shape of the window, and hanging loosely in small volumes. Without the recess are curtains of an exceedingly rich crimson silk, fringed with a deep network of gold, and lined with silver tissue, which is the material of the exterior blind. There are no cornices, but the folds of the whole fabric, which are sharp rather than massive, and have an airy appearance, issue from beneath a broad entablature of rich giltwork, which encircles the room at the junction of the ceiling and walls. The drapery is thrown open also, or closed, by means of a thick rope of gold loosely enveloping it, and resolving itself readily into a knot. No pins or other such devices are apparent. The colors of the curtains and their fringe, the tints of crimson and gold, appear everywhere in profusion, and determine the character of the room. The carpet of Saxony material is quite half an inch thick, and is of the same crimson ground, relieved simply by the appearance of a gold cord, like that festooning the curtains, slightly relieved above the surface of the ground, and thrown upon it in such a manner as to form a succession of short irregular curves, one occasionally overlaying the other. The walls are prepared with a glossy paper of a silver gray tint, spotted with small arabesque devices of a fainter hue of the prevalent crimson. Many paintings relieve the expanse of paper. These are chiefly landscapes of an imaginative cast, such as the fairy grottos of Stanfield, or the lake of the dismal swamp of Chapman. There are, nevertheless, three or four female heads, of an ethereal beauty, portraits in the manner of Sully. The tone of each picture is warm, but dark. There are no brilliant effects. Repose speaks in all. Not one is of small size. Diminutive paintings give that spotty look to a room, which is the blemish of so many a fine work of art overtouched. The frames are broad but not deep, and richly carved, without being dulled or filigreed. They have the whole luster of burnished gold. They lie flat on the walls, and do not hang off with cords. The designs themselves are often seen to better advantage in this latter position, but the general appearance of the chamber is injured. But one mirror, and this not a very large one, is visible. In shape it is nearly circular, and it is hung so that a reflection of the person can be obtained from it in none of the ordinary sitting places of the room. Two large low sofas of rosewood and crimson silk, gold-flowered, form the only seats, with the exception of two light conversation chairs, also of rosewood. There is a pianoforte, rosewood, also, without cover, and thrown open. An octagonal table, formed altogether of the richest gold-threaded marble, is placed near one of the sofas. This is also without cover. The drapery of the curtains has been thought sufficient. Four large and gorgeous Sevres vases, in which bloom a profusion of sweet and vivid flowers, occupy the slightly rounded angles of the room. A tall candelabrum, bearing a small antique lamp with highly perfumed oil, is standing near the head of my sleeping friend. Some light and graceful hanging shelves, with golden edges and crimson silk cords with gold tassels, sustain 200 or 300 magnificently bound books. Beyond these things, there is no furniture, if we accept an argand lamp, with a plain crimson tinted ground glass shade, which depends from his lofty vaulted ceiling by a single slender gold chain, and throws a tranquil but magical radiance over all. A Tale of Jerusalem. Intensus rigidarn in fronternicendere canios. Passus erit, Lucan de Catone. A bristly boar. Let us hurry to the walls, said Abel Fidim to Buzi ben Levi and Simeon the Pharisee, on the 10th day of the month Thamuz, in the year of the world 3941. Let us hasten to the ramparts adjoining the gate of Benjamin, which is in the city of David, and overlooking the camp of the uncircumcised, for it is the last hour of the fourth watch, being sunrise, and the idolaters, in fulfillment of the promise of Pompey, should be awaiting us with the lamps for the sacrifices. Simeon, Abel Fidim, and Uzi ben Levi were the Gizbarim, or sub-collectors of the offering, in the holy city of Jerusalem. Verily, replied the Pharisee, let us hasten, for this generosity in the heathen is unwonted, and fickle-mindedness has ever been an attribute of the worshippers of Baal. That they are fickle-minded and treacherous is as true as the Pentateuch, said Buzi ben Levi, but that is only toward the people of Adonai. When was it ever known that the Ammonites proved wanting to their own interests? Methinks it is no great stretch of generosity to allow us lambs for the altar of the Lord, receiving in lieu thereof 30 silver shekels per head. Thou forgettest, however, Ben Levi, replied Abel Fidim, that the Roman Pompey, who is now impiously besieging the city of the Most High, has no assurity that we apply not the lambs thus purchased for the altar, to the sustenance of the body, rather than of the spirit. Now, by the five corners of my beard, shouted the Pharisee, who belonged to the sect called the Dashers, that little knot of saints whose manner of dashing and lacerating the feet against the pavement was long a thorn and a reproach to less zealous devotees, a stumbling block to less gifted perambulators, by the five corners of that beard which, as a priest, I am forbidden to shave. Have we lived to see the day when a blaspheming and idolatrous upstart of Rome shall accuse us of appropriating to the appetites of the flesh the most holy and consecrated elements? Have we lived to see the day when? Let us not question the motives of the Philistine, interrupted Abel Fidim, for today we profit for the first time by his avarice or by his generosity, But rather let us hurry to the ramparts, lest offerings should be wanting for that altar whose fire the rains of heaven cannot extinguish, and whose pillars of smoke no tempest can turn aside. That part of the city to which our worthy Gizbarim now hastened, and which bore the name of its architect, King David, was esteemed the most strongly fortified district of Jerusalem, being situated upon the steep and lofty hill of Zion. Here, a broad, deep, circumvallatory trench, hewn from the solid rock, was defended by a wall of great strength erected upon its inner edge. This wall was adorned, at regular interspaces, by square towers of white marble, the lowest 60, and the highest 120 cubits in height. But, in the vicinity of the Gate of Benjamin, the wall rose by no means from the margin of the fosse. On the contrary, between the level of the ditch and the basement of the rampart sprang up a perpendicular cliff of 250 cubits, forming part of the precipitous Mount Moriah. So that when Simeon and his associates arrived on the summit of the tower called Adoni Bezek, the loftiest of all the turrets around about Jerusalem, and the usual place of conference with the besieging army, they looked down upon the camp of the enemy from an eminence excelling by many feet that of the Pyramid of Cheops, and, by several, that of the Temple of Belus. "Verily," sighed the Pharisee, as he peered dizzily over the precipice, "the uncircumcised are as the sands by the seashore, as the locusts in the wilderness. The valley of the king hath become the valley of Adoman." "And yet," added Ben Levi, "thou canst not point me out a Philistine, no, not one from Aleph to Tau, from the wilderness to the battlements, who seemeth any bigger than the letter Yod. Lower away the basket with the shekels of silver." Here shouted a Roman soldier in a hoarse, rough voice, which appeared to issue from the regions of Pluto, "lower away the basket with the accursed coin which it has broken the jaw of a noble Roman to pronounce. Is it thus you evince your gratitude to our master Pompeius, who, in his condescension, has thought fit to listen to your idolatrous importunities? The god Phoebus, who is a true god, has been charioted for an hour, and were you not to be on the ramparts by sunrise? Oedipal, do you think that we, the conquerors of the world, have nothing better to do than stand waiting by the walls of every kennel, to traffic with the dogs of the earth? Lower away, I say, and see that your trumpery be bright in color and just in weight." "El Elohim!" ejaculated the Pharisee, as the discordant tones of the centurion rattled up the crags of the precipice, and fainted away against the temple. "El Elohim! Who is the god Phoebus? Whom doth the blasphemer invoke? Thou, Buzi ben Levi, who art read in the laws of the Gentiles, and hast sojourned among them who dabble with the Teraphim. Is it Nergal of whom the idolater speaketh? Or Ashima? Or Nibhaz? Or Tartak? Or Adramelech? Or Anamalej? Or Succoth Beneath? Or Dagon? Or Belial? Or Baal Perith? Or Baal Peor? Or Baalzebub? Verily it is neither, but beware how thou lettest the rope slip too rapidly through thy fingers, for should the wickerwork chance to hang on the projection of yonder crag, there will be a woeful outpouring of the holy things of the sanctuary." By the assistance of some rudely constructed machinery, the heavily laden basket was now carefully lowered down among the multitude, and, from the giddy pinnacle, the Romans were seen gathering confusedly round it, but owing to the vast height and the prevalence of a fog, no distinct view of their operations could be obtained. Half an hour had already elapsed. "We shall be too late," sighed the Pharisee, as at the expiration of this period he looked over into the abyss. "We shall be too late. We shall be turned out of office by the Cathlim." "No more," responded Abel Fittim, "no more shall we feast upon the fat of the land, no longer shall our beards be odorous with frankincense, our loins girded up with fine linen from the temple." "Rackle," swore Ben Levi, "Rackle, do they mean to defraud us of the purchase money? Or, holy Moses, are they weighing the shekels of the tabernacle?" "They have given the signal at last," cried the Pharisee, "they have given the signal at last. Pull away, Abel Fittim. And thou, Buzi ben Levi, pull away. For verily the Philistines have either still hold upon the basket, or the Lord hath softened their hearts to place therein a beast of good weight." And the Gizbarim pulled away, while their burden swung heavily upward through the still increasing mist. Bushohi. As, at the conclusion of an hour, some object at the extremity of the rope became indistinctly visible, "Bushohi!" was the exclamation which burst from the lips of Ben Levi. "Bushohi! For shame! It is a ram from the thickets of En-Gedi, and as rugged as the valley of Jehoshaphat." "It is a firstling of the flock," said Abel Fittim, "I know him by the bleating of his lips, and the innocent folding of his limbs. His eyes are more beautiful than the jewels of the pectoral, and his flesh is like the honey of Hebron." "It is a fatted calf from the pastures of Bashan," said the Pharisee, "the heathen have dealt wonderfully with us, Let us raise up our voices in a psalm. Let us give thanks on the shaman, on the psaltery, on the harp, and on the hagab, on the cithern, and on the sackbut. It was not until their basket had arrived within a few feet of the gizmarim that a low grunt betrayed to their perception a hog of no common size. Now El Amanu. Slowly and with upturned eyes ejaculated the trio, as, letting go their hold, the emancipated porker tumbled headlong among the Philistines. El Amanu. God be with us, it is the unutterable flesh. The Sphinx. During the dread reign of the cholera in New York, I had accepted the invitation of a relative to spend a fortnight with him in the retirement of his cottage or near on the banks of the Hudson. We had here around us all the ordinary means of summer amusement, and what with rambling in the woods, sketching, boating, fishing, bathing, music, and books, we should have passed the time pleasantly enough, but for the fearful intelligence which reached us every morning from the populous city. Not a day elapsed which did not bring us news of the decease of some acquaintance. Then as the fatality increased, we learned to expect daily the loss of some friend. At length we trembled at the approach of every messenger. The very air from the south seemed to us redolent with death. That palsying thought, indeed, took entire possession of my soul. I could neither speak, think, nor dream of anything else. My host was of a less excitable temperament, and, although greatly depressed in spirits, exerted himself to sustain my own. His richly philosophical intellect was not at any time affected by unrealities. To the substances of terror he was sufficiently alive, but of its shadows he had no apprehension. His endeavors to arouse me from the condition of abnormal gloom into which I had fallen, were frustrated, in great measure, by certain volumes which I had found in his library. These were of a character to force into germination whatever seeds of hereditary superstition lay latent in my bosom. I had been reading these books without his knowledge, and thus he was often at a loss to account for the forcible impressions which had been made upon my fancy. A favorite topic with me was the popular belief in omens, a belief which, at this one epoch of my life, I was almost seriously disposed to defend. On this subject we had long and animated discussions, he maintaining the utter groundlessness of faith in such matters, I contending that a popular sentiment arising with absolute spontaneity, that is to say, without apparent traces of suggestion, had in itself the unmistakable elements of truth, and was entitled to as much respect as that intuition which is the idiosyncrasy of the individual man of genius. The fact is, that soon after my arrival at the cottage there had occurred to myself an incident so entirely inexplicable, and which had in it so much of the portentous character, that I might well have been excused for regarding it as an omen. It appalled, and at the same time so confounded and bewildered me, that many days elapsed before I could make up my mind to communicate the circumstances to my friend. Near the close of exceedingly warm day, I was sitting, book in hand, at an open window, commanding, through a long vista of the river banks, a view of a distant hill, the face of which nearest my position had been denuded by what is termed a landslide, of the principal portion of its trees. My thoughts had been long wandering from the volume before me to the gloom and desolation of the neighboring city. Uplifting my eyes from the page, they fell upon the naked face of the bill, and upon an object upon some living monster of hideous conformation, which very rapidly made its way from the summit to the bottom, disappearing finally in the dense forest below. As this creature first came in sight, I doubted my own sanity, or at least the evidence of my own eyes, and many minutes passed before I succeeded in convincing myself that I was neither mad nor in a dream. Yet when I described the monster, which I distinctly saw, and calmly surveyed through the whole period of its progress, my readers, I fear, will feel more difficulty in being convinced of these points than even I did myself. Estimating the size of the creature by comparison with the diameter of the large trees near which it passed the few giants of the forest which had escaped the fury of the landslide, I concluded it to be far larger than any ship of the line in existence. I say ship of the line, because the shape of the monster suggested the idea the hull of one of our 74 might convey a very tolerable conception of the general outline. The mouth of the animal was situated at the extremity of a proboscis some 60 or 70 feet in length, and about as thick as the body of an ordinary elephant. Near the root of this trunk was an immense quantity of black shaggy hair, more than could have been supplied by the coats of a score of buffaloes, and projecting from this hair downwardly and laterally, sprang two gleaming tusks not unlike those of the wild boar, but of infinitely greater dimensions. Extending forward, parallel with the proboscis, and on each side of it, was a gigantic staff, 30 or 40 feet in length, formed seemingly of pure crystal and in shape a perfect prism. It reflected in the most gorgeous manner the rays of the declining sun. The trunk was fashioned like a wedge with the apex to the earth. From it there were outspread two pairs of wings, each wing nearly 100 yards in length, one pair being placed above the other, and all thickly covered with metal scales, each scale apparently some 10 or 12 feet in diameter. I observed that the upper and lower tiers of wings were connected by a strong chain. But the chief peculiarity of this horrible thing was the representation of a death's head, which covered nearly the whole surface of its breast, and which was as accurately traced in glaring white, upon the dark ground of the body, as if it had been there carefully designed by an artist. While I regarded the terrific animal, and more especially the appearance on its breast, with a feeling of horror and awe, with a sentiment of forthcoming evil, which I found it impossible to quell by any effort of the reason, I perceived the huge jaws at the extremity of the proboscis suddenly expand themselves, and from them there proceeded a sound so loud and so expressive of woe, that it struck upon my nerves like a knell, and as the monster disappeared at the foot of the hill, I fell at once, fainting, to the floor. Upon recovering, my first impulse, of course, was to inform my friend of what I had seen and heard, and I can scarcely explain what feeling of repugnance it was which, in the end, operated to prevent me. At length, one evening, some 3 or 4 days after the occurrence, we were sitting together in the room in which I had seen the apparition, I occupying the same seat at the same window, and he lounging on a sofa near at hand. The association of the place and time impelled me to give him an account of the phenomenon. He heard me to the end, at first laughed heartily and then lapsed into an excessively grave demeanor, as if my insanity was a thing beyond suspicion. At this instant I again had a distinct view of the monster, to which, with a shout of absolute terror, I now directed his attention. He looked eagerly but maintained that he saw nothing, although I designated minutely the course of the creature, as it made its way down the naked face of the hill. I was now immeasurably alarmed, for I considered the vision either as an omen of my death, or, worse, as the forerunner of an attack of mania. I threw myself passionately back in my chair, and for some moments buried my face in my hands. When I uncovered my eyes, the apparition was no longer apparent. My host, however, had in some degree resumed the calmness of his demeanor, and questioned me very rigorously in respect to the confirmation of the visionary creature. When I had fully satisfied him on this head, he sighed deeply, as if relieved of some intolerable burden, and went on to talk, with what I thought a cruel calmness, of various points of speculative philosophy, which had heretofore formed subject of discussion between us. I remember his insisting very especially, among other things, upon the idea that the principal source of error in all human investigations lay in the liability of the understanding to underrate or to overvalue the importance of an object, through mere misad measurement of its propinquity. To estimate properly, for example, he said, the influence to be exercised on mankind at large by the thorough diffusion of democracy, the distance of the epoch at which such diffusion may possibly be accomplished should not fail to form an item in the estimate. Yet can you tell me one writer on the subject of government who has ever thought this particular branch of the subject worthy of discussion at all? He here paused for a moment, stepped to a bookcase, and brought forth one of the ordinary synopses of natural history. Requesting me then to exchange seats with him, that he might the better distinguish the fine print of the volume, he took my armchair at the window, and, opening the book, resumed his discourse very much in the same tone as before. "But for your exceeding minuteness," he said, "in describing the monster, I might never have had it in my power to demonstrate to you what it was. In the first place, let me read to you a schoolboy account of the genus Sphinx, of the family Crepuscularia, of the order Lepidoptera, of the class of Insecta or Insects. The account runs thus. 4 membranous wings covered with little colored scales of metallic appearance, mouth forming a rolled proboscis, produced by an elongation of the jaws, upon the sides of which are found the rudiments of mandibles and downy palpi, the inferior wings retained to the superior by a stiff hair, antennae in the form of an elongated club, prismatic, abdomen pointed. The death's-headed sphinx has occasioned much terror among the vulgar, at times, by the melancholy kind of cry which it utters, and the insignia of death which it wears upon its corslet." He here closed the book and leaned forward in the chair, placing himself accurately in the position which I had occupied at the moment of beholding the monster. "Ah, here it is," he presently exclaimed, "it is reascending the face of the hill, and a very remarkable looking creature I admit it to be. Still, it is by no means so large or so distant as you imagined it, for the fact is that, as it wriggles its way up this thread, which some spider has wrought along the window sash, I find it to be about the 1/16 of an inch in its extreme length, and also about the 1/16 of an inch distant from the pupil of my eye." "Hot frog." I never knew anyone so keenly alive to a joke as the king was. He seemed to live only for joking. To tell a good story of the joke kind, and to tell it well, was the surest road to his favor. Thus it happened that his 7 ministers were all noted for their accomplishments as jokers. They all took after the king, too, in being large, corpulent, oily men, as well as inimitable jokers. Whether people grow fat by joking, or whether there is something in fat itself which predisposes to a joke, I have never been quite able to determine, but certain it is that a lean joker is a rara avis in terris. About the refinements, or, as he called them, the ghost of wit, the king troubled himself very little. He had an especial admiration for breadth in a jest, and would often put up with length, for the sake of it. Over niceties wearied him. He would have preferred Rabelais gargantuan to the Zadig of Voltaire, and, upon the whole, practical jokes suited his taste far better than verbal ones. At the date of my narrative, professing jesters had not altogether gone out of fashion at court. Several of the great continental powers still retain their fools, who wore motley, with caps and bells, and who were expected to be always ready with sharp witticisms, at a moment's notice, in consideration of the crumbs that fell from the royal table. Our king, as a matter of course, retained his fool. The fact is, he required something in the way of folly if only to counterbalance the heavy wisdom of the seven wise men who were his ministers, not to mention himself. His fool, or professional jester, was not only a fool, however. His value was trebled in the eyes of the king, by the fact of his being also a dwarf and a cripple. Dwarfs were as common at court, in those days, as fools, and many monarchs would have found it difficult to get through their days. Days are rather longer at court than elsewhere, without both a jester to laugh with, and a dwarf to laugh at. But, as I have already observed, your jesters, in 99 cases out of 100, are fat, round, and unwieldy, so that it was no small source of self-gratulation with our king that, in Hop Frog, this was the fool's name, he possessed a triplicate treasure in one person. I believe the name Hop Frog was not that given to the dwarf by his sponsors at baptism, but it was conferred upon him, by general consent of the several ministers, on account of his inability to walk as other men do. In fact, Hop Frog could only get along by a sort of interjectional gait, something between a leap and a rigolet movement that afforded illimitable amusement, and of course consolation, to the king, for, notwithstanding the protuberance of his stomach and the constitutional swelling of the head, the king, by his whole court, was accounted a capital figure. But although Hop Frog, through the distortion of his legs, could move only with great pain and difficulty along a road or floor, the prodigious muscular power which nature seemed to have bestowed upon his arms, by way of compensation for deficiency in the lower limbs, enabled him to perform many feats of wonderful dexterity, where trees or ropes were in question, or anything else to climb. At such exercises he certainly much more resembled a squirrel, or a small monkey, than a frog. I am not able to say, with precision, from what country Hop Frog originally came. It was from some barbarous region, however, that no person ever heard of a vast distance from the court of our king. Hop Frog, and a young girl very little less dwarfish than himself, although of exquisite proportions, and a marvelous dancer, had been forcibly carried off from their respective homes in adjoining provinces, and sent as presents to the king, by one of his ever-victorious generals. Under these circumstances, it is not to be wondered at that a close intimacy arose between the two little captives. Indeed, they soon became sworn friends. Hop Frog, who, although he made a great deal of sport, was by no means popular, had it not in his power to render Tripetta many services, but she, on account of her grace and exquisite beauty, although a dwarf, was universally admired and petted, so she possessed much influence, and never failed to use it, whenever she could, for the benefit of Hop Frog. On some grand state occasion I forgot what the king determined to have a masquerade, and whenever a masquerade or anything of that kind occurred at our court, then the talents, both of Hop Frog and Tripetta were sure to be called into play. Hop Frog, in especial, was so inventive in the way of getting up pageants, suggesting novel characters, and arranging costumes, for masked balls, that nothing could be done, it seems, without his assistance. The night appointed for the fete had arrived. A gorgeous hall had been fitted up, under Tripetta's eye, with every kind of device which could possibly give éclat to a masquerade. The whole court was in a fever of expectation. As for costumes and characters, it might well be supposed that everybody had come to a decision on such points. Many had made up their minds, as to what roles they should assume, a week, or even a month, in advance, and, in fact, there was not a particle of indecision anywhere except in the case of the king and his seven ministers. Why they hesitated I never could tell, unless they did it by way of a joke. More probably, they found it difficult, on account of being so fat, to make up their minds. At all events, time flew, and, as a last resort they sent for Tripetta and Hop Frog. When the two little friends obeyed the summons of the king they found him sitting at his wine with the seven members of his cabinet council, but the monarch appeared to be in a very ill humor. He knew that Hop Frog was not fond of wine, for it excited the poor cripple almost to madness, and madness is no comfortable feeling. But the king loved his practical jokes, and took pleasure in forcing Hop Frog to drink and, as the king called it, to be merry. "Come here, Hop Frog," said he, as the jester and his friend entered the room, "swallow this bumper to the health of your absent friends," here Hop Frog sighed, "and then let us have the benefit of your invention. We want characters, man, something novel out of the way. We are wearied with this everlasting sameness. Come, drink. The wine will brighten your wits." Hop Frog endeavored, as usual, to get up a jest in reply to these advances from the king, but the effort was too much. It happened to be the poor dwarf's birthday, and the command to drink to his absent friends forced the tears to his eyes. Many large, bitter drops fell into the goblet as he took it, humbly, from the hand of the tyrant. "Ah! Ha! Ha!" roared the latter, as the dwarf reluctantly drained the beaker, "see what a glass of good wine can do. Why, your eyes are shining already." Poor fellow! His large eyes gleamed, rather than shone, for the effect of wine on his excitable brain was not more powerful than instantaneous. He placed the goblet nervously on the table, and looked round upon the company with a half-insane stare. They all seemed highly amused at the success of the king's joke. "And now to business," said the prime minister, a very fat man. "Yes," said the king, "come lend us your assistance. Characters, my fine fellow, we stand in need of characters all of Usha." "Ha! Ha!" And as this was seriously meant for a joke, his laugh was chorused by the seven. Hop Frog also laughed, although feebly and somewhat vacantly. "Come, come," said the king, impatiently, "have you nothing to suggest?" "I am endeavoring to think of something novel," replied the dwarf, abstractedly, for he was quite bewildered by the wine. "Endeavoring!" cried the tyrant, fiercely, "what do you mean by that? Ah, I perceive. You are sulky, and want more wine. Here, drink this." And he poured out another goblet full and offered it to the cripple, who merely gazed at it, gasping for breath. "Drink, I say!" shouted the monster, "or by the fiends." The dwarf hesitated. The king grew purple with rage. The courtiers smirked. Tripita, pale as a corpse, advanced to the monarch's seat, and, falling on her knees before him, implored him to spare her friend. The tyrant regarded her, for some moments, in evident wonder at her audacity. He seemed quite at a loss what to do or say how most becomingly to express his indignation. At last, without uttering a syllable, he pushed her violently from him, and threw the contents of the brimming goblet in her face. The poor girl got up the best she could, and, not daring even to sigh, resumed her position at the foot of the table. There was a dead silence for about half a minute, during which the falling of a leaf, or of a feather, might have been heard. It was interrupted by a low, but harsh and protracted grating sound which seemed to come at once from every corner of the room. What are you making that noise for?" demanded the king, turning furiously to the dwarf. The latter seemed to have recovered, in great measure, from his intoxication, and looking fixedly but quietly into the tyrant's face, merely ejaculated, "Aye, how could it have been me?" "The sound appeared to come from without," observed one of the courtiers. "I fancy it was the parrot at the window, wetting his bill upon his cage wires." "True," replied the monarch, as if much relieved by the suggestion, "but, on the honor of a knight, I could have sworn that it was the gritting of this vagabond's teeth." Hereupon the dwarf laughed. The king was too confirmed a joker to object to anyone's laughing, and displayed a set of large, powerful, and very repulsive teeth. Moreover, he avowed his perfect willingness to swallow as much wine as desired. The monarch was pacified, and having drained another bumper with no very perceptible ill effect, Hop Frog entered at once, and with spirit, into the plans for the masquerade. "I cannot tell what was the association of idea," observed he, very tranquilly, and as if he had never tasted wine in his life, "but just after your majesty had struck the girl and thrown the wine in her face, just after your majesty had done this, and while the parrot was making that odd noise outside the window, there came into my mind a capital diversion one of my own country frolics often enacted among us, at our masquerades, but here it will be new altogether. Unfortunately, however, it requires a company of 8 persons and here we are," cried the king, laughing at his acute discovery of the coincidence, 8 to a fraction, I and my 7 ministers. "Come. What is the diversion?" "We call it," replied the cripple, "the 8 chained orang-outangs, and it really is excellent sport if well enacted." "We will enact it," remarked the king, drawing himself up, and lowering his eyelids. "The beauty of the game," continued Hop Frog, lies in the frighted occasions among the women. Capital! Roared in chorus the monarch and his ministry. I will equip you as orangutans, proceeded the dwarf, leave all that to me. The resemblance shall be so striking, that the company of masqueraders will take you for real beasts and of course, they will be as much terrified as astonished. Oh, this is exquisite! Exclaimed the king. Hop Frog! I will make a man of you. The chains are for the purpose of increasing the confusion by their jangling. You are supposed to have escaped, en masse, from your keepers. Your majesty cannot conceive the effect produced, at a masquerade, by 8 chained orangutans, imagined to be real ones by most of the company, and rushing in with savage cries, among the crowd of delicately and gorgeously habited men and women. The contrast is inimitable. It must be, said the king, and the counselor rose hurriedly, as it was growing late, to put in execution the scheme of Hop Frog. His mode of equipping the party as orangutans was very simple, but effective enough for his purposes. The animals in question had, at the epoch of my story, very rarely been seen in any part of the civilized world, and as the imitations made by the dwarf were sufficiently beast-like and more than sufficiently hideous, their truthfulness to nature was thus thought to be secured. The king and his ministers were first encased in tight-fitting stockinette shirts and drawers. They were then saturated with tar. At this stage of the process, someone of the party suggested feathers, but the suggestion was at once overruled by the dwarf, who soon convinced the 8, by ocular demonstration, that the hair of such a brute as the orangutan was much more efficiently represented by flue. A thick coating of the latter was accordingly plastered upon the coating of tar. A long chain was now procured. First, it was passed about the waist of the king, and tied, then about another of the party, and also tied, then about all successively, in the same manner. When this chaining arrangement was complete, and the party stood as far apart from each other as possible, they formed a circle, and to make all things appear natural, Hop Frog passed the residue of the chain in 2 diameters, at right angles, across the circle, after the fashion adopted, at the present day, by those who capture chimpanzees, or other large apes, in Borneo. The grand saloon in which the masquerade was to take place, was a circular room, very lofty, and receiving the light of the sun only through a single window atop. At night, the season for which the apartment was especially designed, it was illuminated principally by a large chandelier, depending by a chain from the center of the skylight, and lowered, or elevated, by means of a counterbalance as usual, but, in order not to look unsightly, this latter passed outside the cupola and over the roof. The arrangements of the room had been left to Tripita's superintendence, but, in some particulars, it seems, she had been guided by the calmer judgment of her friend the dwarf. At his suggestion it was that, on this occasion, the chandelier was removed. Its waxen drippings, which, in weather so warm, it was quite impossible to prevent, would have been seriously detrimental to the rich dresses of the guests, who, on account of the crowded state of the saloon, could not all be expected to keep from out its center, that is to say, from under the chandelier. Additional sconces were set in various parts of the hall, out of the war, and a flambeau, emitting sweet odor, was placed in the right hand of each of the caryatides, that stood against the wall some 50 or 60 altogether. The 8 orangutans, taking Hop Frog's advice, waited patiently until midnight, when the room was thoroughly filled with masqueraders, before making their appearance. No sooner had the clock ceased striking, however, than they rushed, or rather rolled in, all together, for the impediments of their chains caused most of the party to fall, and all to stumble as they entered. The excitement among the masqueraders was prodigious, and filled the heart of the king with glee. As had been anticipated, there were not a few of the guests who supposed the ferocious-looking creatures to be beasts of some kind in reality, if not precisely orangutans. Many of the women swooned with affright, and had not the king taken the precaution to exclude all weapons from the saloon, his party might soon have expiated their frolic and their blood. As it was, a general rush was made for the doors, but the king had ordered them to be locked immediately upon his entrance, and, at the dwarf's suggestion, the keys had been deposited with him. While the tumult was at its height, and each masquerader attentive only to his own safety, for, in fact, there was much real danger from the pressure of the excited crowd, the chain by which the chandelier ordinarily hung, and which had been drawn up on its removal, might have been seen very gradually to descend, until its hooked extremity came within 3 feet of the floor. Soon after this, the king and his 7 friends, having reeled about the hall in all directions, found themselves, at length, in its center, and, of course, in immediate contact with the chain. While they were thus situated, the dwarf, who had followed noiselessly at their heels, inciting them to keep up the commotion, took hold of their own chain at the intersection of the two portions which crossed the circle diametrically and at right angles. Here, with the rapidity of thought, he inserted the hook from which the chandelier had been wont to depend, and, in an instant, by some unseen agency, the chandelier chain was drawn so far upward as to take the hook out of reach, and, as an inevitable consequence, to drag the orangutans together in close connection, and face to face. The masqueraders, by this time, had recovered, in some measure, from their alarm, and, beginning to regard the whole matter as a well-contrived pleasantry, set up a loud shout of laughter at the predicament of the apes. "Leave them to me!" now screamed Hop Frog, his shrill voice making itself easily heard through all the din. "Leave them to me. I fancy I know them. If I can only get a good look at them, I can soon tell who they are." Here, scrambling over the heads of the crowd, he managed to get to the wall, when, seizing a flambeau from one of the caryatides, he returned, as he went, to the center of the room leaping, with the agility of a monkey, upon the king's head, and thence clambered a few feet up the chain, holding down the torch to examine the group of orangutans, and still screaming, "I shall soon find out who they are." And now, while the whole assembly, the apes included, were convulsed with laughter, the jester suddenly uttered a shrill whistle, when the chain flew violently up for about 30 feet, dragging with it the dismayed and struggling orangutans, and leaving them suspended in midair between the skylight and the floor. Hop Frog, clinging to the chain as it rose, still maintained his relative position in respect to the eight maskers, and still, as if nothing were the matter, continued to thrust his torch down toward them, as though endeavoring to discover who they were. So thoroughly astonished was the whole company at this ascent, that a dead silence, of about a minute's duration, ensued. It was broken by just such a low, harsh, grating sound, as had before attracted the attention of the king and his counselors when the former threw the wine in the face of Tripita. But, on the present occasion, there could be no question as to whence the sound issued. It came from the fang-like teeth of the dwarf, who ground them and gnashed them as he foamed at the mouth, and glared, with an expression of maniacal rage, into the upturned countenances of the king and his seven companions. "Ah, ha!" said at length the infuriated jester. "Ah, ha! I begin to see who these people are now." Here, pretending to scrutinize the king more closely, he held the flambeau to the flaxen coat which enveloped him, and which instantly burst into a sheet of vivid flame. In less than half a minute the whole eight orangutans were blazing fiercely, amid the shrieks of the multitude who gazed at them from below, horror-stricken, and without the power to render them the slightest assistance. At length the flames, suddenly increasing in virulence, forced the jester to climb higher up the chain, to be out of their reach, and, as he made this movement, the crowd again sank, for a brief instant, into silence. The dwarf seized his opportunity, and once more spoke. "I now see distinctly," he said, "what manner of people these maskers are. They are a great king and his seven privy counselors, a king who does not scruple to strike a defenseless girl and his seven counselors who abet him in the outrage. As for myself, I am simply Hop Frog, the jester, and this is my last jest." Owing to the high combustibility of both the flax and the tar to which it adhered, the dwarf had scarcely made an end of his brief speech before the work of vengeance was complete. The eight corpses swung in their chains, a fetid, blackened, hideous, and indistinguishable mass. The cripple hurled his torch at them, clambered leisurely to the ceiling, and disappeared through the skylight. It is supposed that Tripita, stationed on the roof of the saloon, had been the accomplice of her friend in his fiery revenge, and that, together, they effected their escape to their own country, for neither was seen again the man of the crowd. "C'est grand malheur, de ne pouvoir être seul. La Bruyère." It was well said of a certain German book that her lest sich nicht lesen it does not permit itself to be read. There are some secrets which do not permit themselves to be told. Men die nightly in their beds, wringing the hands of ghostly confessors and looking them piteously in the eyes, die with despair of heart and convulsion of throat, on account of the hideousness of mysteries which will not suffer themselves to be revealed. Now and then, alas, the conscience of man takes up a burthen so heavy in horror that it can be thrown down only into the grave. And thus the essence of all crime is undivulged. Not long ago, about the closing in of an evening in autumn, I sat at the large bow window of the D coffee house in London. For some months I had been ill in health, but was now convalescent, and, with returning strength, found myself in one of those happy moods which are so precisely the converse of ennui, moods of the keenest appetency, when the film from the mental vision departs the Greek phrase and the intellect, electrified, surpasses as greatly its everyday condition, as does the vivid yet candid reason of Leibniz, the mad and flimsy rhetoric of Gorgias. Merely to breathe was enjoyment, and I derived positive pleasure even from many of the legitimate sources of pain. I felt a calm but inquisitive interest in everything. With a cigar in my mouth and a newspaper in my lap, I had been amusing myself for the greater part of the afternoon, now in poring over advertisements, now in observing the promiscuous company in the room, and now in peering through the smoky panes into the street. This latter is one of the principal thoroughfares of the city, and had been very much crowded during the whole day. But, as the darkness came on, the throng momently increased, and, by the time the lamps were well lighted, two dense and continuous tides of population were rushing past the door. At this particular period of the evening I had never before been in a similar situation, and the tumultuous sea of human heads filled me, therefore, with a delicious novelty of emotion. I gave up, at length, all care of things within the hotel, and became absorbed in contemplation of the scene without. At first my observations took an abstract and generalizing turn. I looked at the passengers in masses, and thought of them in their aggregate relations. Soon, however, I descended to details, and regarded with minute interest the innumerable varieties of figure, dress, air, gait, visage, and expression of countenance. By far the greater number of those who went by had a satisfied business-like demeanor, and seemed to be thinking only of making their way through the press. Their brows were knit, and their eyes rolled quickly, when pushed against by fellow wayfarers they evinced no symptom of impatience, but adjusted their clothes and hurried on. Others, still a numerous class, were restless in their movements, had flushed faces, and talked and gesticulated to themselves, as if feeling in solitude on account of the very denseness of the company around. When impeded in their progress, these people suddenly ceased muttering, but redoubled their gesticulations, and awaited, with an absent and overdone smile upon lips, the course of the persons impeding them. If jostled, they bowed profusely to the jostlers, and appeared overwhelmed with confusion. There was nothing very distinctive about these two large classes beyond what I have noted. Their habiliments belonged to that order which is pointedly termed the decent. They were undoubtedly noblemen, merchants, attorneys, tradesmen, stockjobbers, the upper trades and the commonplaces of society, men of leisure and men actively engaged in affairs of their own, conducting business upon their own responsibility. They did not greatly excite my attention. The tribe of clerks was an obvious one, and here I discerned two remarkable divisions. There were the junior clerks of flash houses, young gentlemen with tight coats, bright boots, well-oiled hair, and supercilious lips. Setting aside a certain dapperness of carriage, which may be termed esquism for want of a better word, the manner of these persons seemed to me an exact facsimile of what had been the perfection of bon ton about 12 or 18 months before. They wore the cast-off graces of the gentry, and this, I believe, involves the best definition of the class. The division of the upper clerks of staunch firms, or of the steady old fellows, it was not possible to mistake. These were known by their coats and pantaloons of black or brown, made to sit comfortably, with white cravats and waistcoats, broad solid-looking shoes, and thick hose or gaiters. They had all slightly bald heads, from which the right ears, long used to pen-holding, had an odd habit of standing off on end. I observed that they always removed or settled their hats with both hands, and wore watches, with short gold chains of a substantial and ancient pattern. Theirs was the affectation of respectability, if indeed there be an affectation so honorable. There were many individuals of dashing appearance, whom I easily understood as belonging to the race of swell pickpockets with which all great cities are infested. I watched these gentry with much inquisitiveness, and found it difficult to imagine how they should ever be mistaken for gentlemen by gentlemen themselves. Their voluminousness of wristband, with an air of excessive frankness, should betray them at once. The gamblers, of whom I described not a few, were still more easily recognizable. They wore every variety of dress, from that of the desperate thimble-rig bully, with velvet waistcoat, fancy neckerchief, gilt chains, and filigreed buttons, to that of the scrupulously and ornate clergyman, than which nothing could be less liable to suspicion. Still all were distinguished by a certain sodden swarthiness of complexion, a filmy dimness of eye, and pallor and compression of lip. There were two other traits, moreover, by which I could always detect them: a guarded lowness of tone in conversation, and a more than ordinary extension of the thumb in a direction at right angles with the fingers. Very often, in